Chapter 32. Geoffrey heard his own footsteps through the suit's auditory acoustic pickup, and the timbre was different now, each footfall accompanied by a distinct steel-edged echo. The open door had shown only darkness, and it was no lighter now that they were on the other side of it, cut off from the Quaenor. He felt as if he'd climbed into the hold of a ship, some huge metal-walled void with no windows. "There's an image intensifier mode on these things," Jemai said, quietly, as if there were things astir that she did not wish to alert. "Voke amplification, see what you make of it." Jemai was never more than an arm's reach away, her form outlined on the helmet's display. Geoffrey did as she had suggested, voking the suit to apply a light-enhanced overlay. Grey-green perspectives raced away from him, curving in one direction, arrow straight in the other. He pivoted around, Jemai manifesting as a blazing white smudge. The floor angled up behind her, commencing its great, steepening arc, the arc that would eventually bring it soaring overhead and back down behind him. At right angles to the direction of the curvature, the floor stretched all the way to the far end cap. He couldn't see anything of the end cap. There wasn't enough ambient light for that. "This isn't right," he said, shaking his head inside the helmet. "It shouldn't be like this." "You want to let me in on what you're expecting?" "I've never been here before," Geoffrey said, "but I'm very familiar with this space. From whenever she talked to us, whenever she delivered one of her sermons." The words were a struggle. "This wasn't just an empty shell. It was full of trees, full of greenery and light, like a jungle. There were plants, borders, paths, and stairs. It rained. There should be a whole closed cycle ecology running in here."
"Looks more like a room full of nothing," Jemai said.
"Arethusa was here. She chinged aboard not long before Eunice died. She'd have noticed anything strange. She'd have said something to me." Jemai had her hands on her hips. She was looking up towards the central axis of the empty chamber.
"At least there's a ship. That is a ship, isn't it?"
"I think so." But he could hardly tell. It was nearly 75 meters away. All he could make out was a spine of organized darkness running from one end of the chamber to the other. "We need more light," Geoffrey said decisively. "Is there a flashlight mode somewhere? I'm surprised it hasn't cut in automatically."
"Maybe there are situations where you wouldn't want that to happen. Wait a second."
Jemai reached up and started fiddling with the crown of her helmet.
"Thought I saw something while we were suiting up. Got some flares in my toolkit, all else fails."
Light blazed from her helmet. She doused the blue-white beam against the central axis, picking out details of the Winter Queen. Geoffrey felt his world lurch slightly back into sanity, if only for a few lucid moments. He was still reeling from the absence of the jungle. Even if the air in the chamber had been swapped for pure oxygen and allowed to consume itself, there'd still be ashes, scorching, yet there was nothing. The flooring under his feet had the improbable antiseptic gleam of an AirPod showroom, but the ship was real. He'd activated his own helmet lamp and was sweeping the beam along the nearest part of the Winter Queen. The Deep Space Explorer was a kilometer long, and even though part of that length was now absorbed into the end caps, he still couldn't see more than a fifth of it. Yet the anatomy was unmistakable, from the cluster of fuel tanks above him to the delicate filigreed spine with its branching black complexity of fractally folded radiator veins. He'd seen this ship a thousand times in countless family histories. Everything about it looked correct. But this wasn't the rotting, rusted, tree-encased carcass he'd been expecting. Winter Queen wasn't garlanded with humid green overgrowth, and she wasn't laced with solar lights and an irrigation system. There were no spiral staircases rising from the floor to puncture her hull. She did not look as if she'd been stuck in here for decades. She looked ravishingly, sparklingly new.
"Enough of this shit," Jemai said.
Her glowing form reached down and scooped something out of the holdall she'd dropped at her feet. She did something to the object in her hand, and it quickened into impossible brilliance.
She tossed the little ball of light along the floor, where it bounced and rolled and then began to propel itself with a curious willingness until it came to a rolling stop 200 or 300 meters away. Jumai did the same thing with a second flare. They lit the entire chamber. Geoffrey squinted against the brightness until his eyes amped down their response. His suspicions were confirmed now. The ship looked as pristine as its surroundings, the two opposed centrifuge arms, 180 meters from tip to tip, were still turning, whooshing around like the blades of a wind turbine. The capsule-shaped living pods at either end of the arms skimmed the ground with only a meter or so to spare. "Why are they still turning?" Geoffrey asked. "There's already gravity in this place." Jumai looked at the swinging arms. "How fast are we spinning?" Geoffrey recalled what he'd learned on the approach. "About 3 times a minute, give or take."
"Then they're not spinning fast enough to counteract the habitat's rotation either. I thought maybe someone had gone to a lot of trouble to recreate weightlessness for whatever reason. But that's not it. Those arms can't be swinging around faster than once every couple of minutes, relative to us."
"Must be a systems glitch then," Geoffrey said. "Something inside blew a fuse and the arms started up again. Or maybe it's just to keep the air circulating, like a god's own ceiling fan." Jumai scratched the back of her helmet as if she had an itch.
"As breathable, you realize. Someone went to that much trouble. I'm beginning to wonder if anyone ever actually put that to the test."
"Memphis would have breathed it.
If he ever came this far. And if he did, well, he lied to you, didn't he? Big time."
Geoffrey wasn't keen to follow that thought to its conclusion. "I see something," he said. "High above us, under the path of the centrifuge arms." He pointed, and Jumai followed his gaze to the indistinct form he'd sighted, pinned to the ceiling like a squashed fly.
"Got to be Hector.
He's not moving."
Somewhere in the suit, there had to be a mode for zooming in the faceplate view, but Geoffrey couldn't be bothered searching for it now.
"I wonder if he knows we're here. There's no aug reach, but suit-to-suit comms are still good."
He didn't want to voice the possibility that Hector might be dead, however plausible that now looked. Jumai grabbed the holdall and broke into a surprisingly loose-limbed run, the suit easily accommodating her intentions. Geoffrey followed, keen to reach his cousin, but anxious about what they might find. Whatever had hurt Hector might still be present. But where could anything or anyone hide in this vast, empty space? Unless Hector's attacker had retreated back into the far end cap wall, the only possible hiding place was the ship itself. He didn't like that idea at all. Even running against the spin of the habitat, Geoffrey didn't feel his own weight varying to any perceptible degree. They cut diagonally, Jumai tossing out another flare along the way, and slowed to a walk when they were about 100 meters from the suited figure. The centrifuge booms were still turning, and now that they were closer, there was a clear whoosh each time one of the capsules swept by them. The arms were not moving particularly quickly, scarcely more than running pace compared to the floor, but Geoffrey nonetheless had an impression of enormous, dangerous momentum. Hector, who else could it possibly be, was on his back, spread-eagled and motionless, staring straight up towards the central axis and the Winter Queen. Next to him, resting on the ground, was a white rectangular box like a big first aid kit. Traceries of luminous arterial red ran down the suit's matte black limbs and defined the form of the chest plate and helmet. The Akinia Space logo glowed on the upper shoulder joint of the nearest arm. Geoffrey approached the form, always keeping the centrifuge arms in view. As one of the capsules sped past him, he grasped what must have happened to his cousin. There was a door in the capsule, a dark circular aperture in the leading hemisphere.
Hector was trying to get inside.
Figures,
Jumai said slowly.
I mean, he would, wouldn't he? Comes this way, finds things aren't the way they're meant to be. What else is he going to do but try to get aboard the ship?
She took a step back as the other capsule whooshed by.
Think this was a surprise to him?
Geoffrey had no adequate answer for that,
Only intuition. I don't like Hector, he said. Don't trust him either, but I don't think he was expecting to find this place empty.
He got up close to Hector's visor, trying to make out the face behind the glass. There wasn't one.
The suit's empty.
Jemai knelt down and double-checked, as if he could possibly have been mistaken.
I don't get it.
He must have removed the suit, then told it to wait here for him. That's what it's doing, just lying there, waiting.
I know there's air in here, but why would anyone be lunatic enough to get out of a perfectly good spacesuit?
Geoffrey looked at the next centrifuge pod to swing past them, at the tiny door in its side. A suited figure could squeeze through the aperture. There'd have been little point in having it otherwise, but it would have been all but impossible to time the transition from floor to moving component. Unencumbered by a suit, though, and for a man who was fit and agile enough to play both tennis and polo and excel at both, Geoffrey wondered. I think he wanted to get aboard the ship. He couldn't do it with the suit on, too sluggish, too clumsy, so he got out of it. Told it to wait here until he was ready to leave.
We haven't seen him, Jemai said. There's another way out of the Winter Palace, of course.
But he wouldn't have left without putting the suit back on. I think he's still inside the ship. Cautiously, as if he might be working a jack-in-the-box, Geoffrey eased open the cover on the white container and saw four small cylindrical devices packed like stubby beer bottles. There were four empty spaces next to them. He tugged one of the pump cylinders out of its cushioned support matrix. It was heavy and cold, with a sturdy flip-up arming mechanism built into the cap. The label was in Swahili, with other languages printed underneath in smaller type. Caution, metastable metallic hydrogen, he read. This is a variable yield explosive device. Do not tamper with, shock, or expose to temperatures in excess of 400 Kelvin, magnetic fields in excess of 1 Tesla, or ambient pressures in excess of 100 atmospheres. If found, immediately notify Akinya Space Deep System Resources.
You don't think he came with just the four, do you?
Jemai said. Perhaps. On the other hand, maybe he took the other four into the ship.
And set the fuses, and then issued a distress call because something happened to him in there.
Jemai was speaking very slowly, as if she did not much care for the direction her thoughts were taking her.
Something that meant he couldn't get back out again on his own.
We might be in trouble, Geoffrey said. You think those charges would be enough to blow up the whole habitat? Don't need to be. There's a nuclear drive inside the ship.
He turned the demolition charge around, studying the fine settings around the flip-up arming device.
There was a twist dial and a locking failsafe. Tiny numerals were engraved into the twist dial. Must be a way to trigger these remotely. But there's also a timer mode. It goes 10, 20, 30, 60, 90.
Seconds or minutes?
Minutes, I hope.
Geoffrey slid the charge back into the box, treating it as gingerly as he would a Ming vase.
We don't know that he set the timers, but it's a possibility we can't ignore.
He called in the Kinyeti more than an hour ago, Jemai said. If he armed those fuses and then ran into trouble, it can't be the 60-minute fuse. But that still doesn't give us a lot of time to get out of here. We should start back now and tell the Quaenor to pull away as soon as we're in the lock.
That's an excellent idea.
Geoffrey voked through visor menus until he found the option for suit removal. Typically, there were 8 or 9 hurdles to jump before the suit accepted that he really, honestly meant to get out of it.
But one of us has to go up there and get Hector. I'll disarm the fuses if I'm able. Otherwise, I'll find him and get the two of us out of there as quickly as possible. If I can't save Hector, I'll save myself.
No, Jemai said. That's not how it's going to happen. And we don't have time to argue about it.
Geoffrey's suit had begun to detach itself, opening like a crafty puzzle, to reveal the human prize at its heart. The air in the chamber hit his lungs. He'd seen no point in holding his breath, so he gulped it down eagerly. Beyond a brief coughing fit, triggered by the air's coldness, there were no ill effects.
Listen carefully, he told Jemai. If Hector's hurt in any way,
He won't be much use in that suit. I can carry him back the way he came in, if it comes to that, and he can get me through any doors we meet on the way. He passed through them on his way here, after all. But there's no way I'd be able to get him up that shaft we already came down. So how the hell do you get out?
Hector's ferry. There'll be room aboard for both of us.
He put a hand on the armored swell of her shoulder joint before she could voice an objection.
I'm not suicidal, Jemai, but I can't just leave him to die aboard that ship. As soon as you're back in Orgreach, tell Mira and Arethusa to decouple and get away as quickly as possible. The Pans will wait for you or leave one of the Quanar's own escape pods docked at the hub for you to use. If all else fails, vent the airlock and use the explosive decompression to push you away from the station. It'll only take you a few minutes to reach safe distance. I may not know much about spaceflight, but I know there are no shockwaves in vacuum, and the debris cloud will attenuate very quickly.
And you?
This is the only way.
It sucks.
Yes, it does. But the more time we spend discussing this, the less time we have for making it work.
Jeffrey raised his voice.
Go, now. We'll both be fine.
Jemai hesitated, then started to retrace her steps. She turned back once or twice, but Jeffrey was waiting until she was gone before he chanced his luck with the centrifuge. If it went wrong, he didn't want Jemai risking her own neck to save his. He waited for the next pod to come around, studying it more closely than he had before. The aperture was in the front as the pod travelled, but if he simply stood his ground and waited for it to arrive, he'd be swatted aside like a fly. Better to run alongside it as fast as he could and spring aboard. He couldn't match its speed, but he could reduce the relative motion to the point where he ought to be able to grab a hold of the pod without being injured or flung aside. There were handholds around the pod's circumference. They'd been put there for weightless operations, but they would serve his purpose equally well. When he was certain that Jemai was either out of the chamber or far enough away that she couldn't see him, he stationed himself as close to the path of the pods as he dared. Divested of his suit, he felt the breeze as they passed. He gulped in deep, cold breaths and began to jog. The next pod whisked past his right shoulder. It was moving faster than he'd anticipated. He increased his pace, transitioning from a jog to a run. He kept his eyes on the ground, tracking a fine seam in the floor, making sure he didn't deviate more than a few centimeters either side of it. The next pod arrived. It was still fast, but he'd cut down the relative motion to the point where jumping aboard no longer appeared insanely impossible. His feet hammered the metal plates. He was not yet running at his limit, but he might have to sustain this pace for several minutes. When the next pod passed, he upped his speed again. His lungs began to hurt. Now the relative speed couldn't be more than 2 meters a second, but this was not a pace he could sustain indefinitely. The pods had taken about 2 minutes to complete their revolutions before, but now they had to catch up with a moving reference point, and the interval was closer to 3 minutes. He thought again of the timer fuses on the demolition charges. Was this madness, even attempting to get aboard the Winter Queen? When the next pod came, he made his move. One chance only, he figured. If he was knocked to the ground, if his ankle twisted under him, he'd never have the strength to make a second attempt. Part of him hoped it would happen that way. Make a gesture, an effort to reach Hector. That would be sufficient, wouldn't it? He could go home with a clear conscience, knowing he'd tried. He grasped for the handhold with his right hand, and an instant later had his left in place as well. For a second or so, he was able to keep pace with the pod, but then his legs buckled under him and he was being dragged. Putting as much strength into his arms as he was able, he levered himself further from the ground. He was facing back the way he'd come now, like a rider about to mount a horse, his heels skimming the floor. With a grunt of supreme effort, he managed to hook his right leg onto one of the handholds, like a foot into a stirrup, and then his left leg followed. He was aboard the pod, but not inside it. He was facing the wrong way, gripping the outside, one slip away from tumbling off. He twisted round, keeping his hands and feet where they were. The only thing in his favour was that he was now slightly lighter than when he had been standing. The
The centrifuge's own rotation was working against the overall spin of the Winter Palace. Geoffrey adjusted his position. He moved his right hand onto the same handhold as the left, and then moved the left as far back over his shoulder as he was able without throwing himself dangerously off balance. He caught his breath, knowing he could only hold the posture for a few seconds. He could not adjust the position of his legs until he swung himself into space again, holding on with just his hands. Taking another breath, calculating the movement he would have to make, rehearsing exactly where he would plant his feet when momentum brought him back in contact with the pod, he committed. Something twisted in his wrist. The pain was intense, a dagger into a nerve, but it was also momentary. He forced himself not to let go, grunting away the discomfort. His left foot recontacted the pod, then his right. He scrambled for a more secure hold, his right heel sliding against the pod's curving side. Then he was safe. Geoffrey allowed himself a minute to gather his energies before continuing. It was not difficult to reach the entrance hole, although it required care. Under other circumstances, knowing that something had already happened to Hector, he would have entered it with immense caution. Scarcely an option now. He swung himself inside, and as he hit the padded floor, all he felt was relief at no longer having to clutch onto the handholds. His wrist ached. His shoulder muscles were protesting. His legs were burning from the exertion. But he was aboard the Winter Queen. The pod's interior was bathroom-sized. There were fold-down stools and a table, a couple of screens. Sufficient for a game of cards, but even without suits on, it would be very cramped in here with more than two people. The pods weren't meant for extended habitation, though. The idea would be to spend a few hours per day under normal or even slightly higher than normal gravitation to offset the calcium depletion and muscle wasting of prolonged weightlessness. Given that Eunice had been alone in her final deep space voyage, elbow room had hardly been an issue. He looked up, along the spoke that connected the pod to the spacecraft's central axis. 90 meters, more or less the same distance they'd already traversed after entering the habitat. There was a ladder, and just enough room for one person to climb it. Before cramp set in, he made a start on the ascent. His limbs protested, the ache in his wrist sharpening, but as he ascended, so his effective weight gradually decreased and the effort became endurable. Every 10 meters or so, the ladder reached a platform and swapped sides, so that there was no risk of falling all the way down. He wondered why they hadn't arranged an elevator, but a moment's consideration made it plain enough. The whole point of the centrifuge arm was to work bone and muscle. Climbing up and down was part of the exercise. The air in the ship was free to mix with that in the chamber, but there was a metallic quality to it that he didn't remember from before. It smelled antiseptic, like a hospital corridor that had been vigorously scrubbed and polished. Nor was it as cold as the air outside. In addition to the warmth, ship sounds were now reaching his ears. He heard the electric hum of what he presumed to be the centrifuge mechanism, and beyond that, the muted chug of onboard life support and air circulation, like a showroom full of refrigerators. 3 minutes after commencing his ascent, Geoffrey was weightless again. He had reached the transition collar where the rotary movement of the centrifuge met the fixed reference frame of the main hull. An oval hole slid slowly by, rimmed with cushioning. Hector had come at least this far. Geoffrey pushed himself through the hole the next time it appeared. There was ample time to complete the maneuver, and he didn't doubt that there were safety mechanisms waiting to cut off the centrifuge's rotation should he somehow imperil himself. He floated into the lit core of the Winter Queen and assessed his surroundings. He was amidships. Aft lay the engine assembly and the nuclear power plant. Fore lay the command deck. He was hanging in a corridor, hexagonal in cross-section, with panels and lockers arranged in longitudinal strips. Between the strips were recessed ladders, grip pads, and handholds. The main lights were on, and everything looked very clean and tidy. Not at all like a ship that had been to the edge of the solar system and back, much less one that had been lived in for 60-odd years. Jeffrey picked at the edge of a striped warning decal, bordering what the glass pane identified as an emergency bulkhead control. Not even a hint of dirt around the edge of the decal. His own fingernails were grubbier. Nothing stayed that new, not with human beings in the loop.
"Hector?" Jeffrey called. "Can you hear me?"
No answer. Not that that necessarily meant anything, since the ship was big, and there were undoubtedly soundproof doors between its various internal sections. But which way had his cousin gone? Tossing a mental coin, Jeffrey decided to check out the command deck first. Trusting his orientation, he set off down the corridor using the handholds and straps for traction. He was glad he'd had time to adjust to weightlessness on the Quaenor. The corridor jinked right, then left, squeezing past some fuel tank or external equipment module, he guessed. And then there was a door blocking his path. A small window was set into the door, but all he could see through that was a short space and another door beyond it. Bracing himself, conscious that he wasn't wearing a suit and that he had no reason to assume the entire ship was pressurized, he reached out and palmed what was obviously the door's operating control. An amber light flicked to green and the door gapped apart in two interlocking halves. He pushed through into the space beyond, the door closing almost before he'd cleared the gap. He arrested his drift and palmed open the second door. There was air beyond. He continued his exploration. By his reckoning, Jeffrey thought he must be halfway to the front of the ship by now. The corridor he was moving along was wider than the others, and there were rooms, or more properly, compartments, leading off from it. He spared them the briefest of glances as he passed. Most were large enough to serve as private chambers for individual crew members, and indeed one or two came equipped with bunks and other fold-out amenities. But again, there was no sign that anything had ever been used. He passed a couple of larger chambers, a dining area, a commons room, a sick bay, all the chrome and pea-green equipment gleaming and shrink-wrapped, as if it had just been ordered out of the catalogue and installed yesterday. A zero-G gym, a kind of cinema or lecture theatre, more storage lockers and equipment bays, lots of equipment, spacesuits, vacuum repair gear, medical and food supplies, even a couple of stowed proxies, waiting to be called into service. The proxies were surprisingly modern-looking for a ship that hadn't gone anywhere since 2101. Did they even have proxies back then? Jeffrey wondered. He moved on. Around him, the ship chugged and whirred and clicked. It was much warmer now, almost uncomfortably so, and Jeffrey was beginning to sweat under the spacesuit inner layer. He passed a pair of large eggshell white rooms furnished with hibernation cabinets, streamlined sarcophagi. They were Hitachi units, plastered with medical logos, instructions, and graphic warning decals. There were six cabinets, which made no sense at all. Winter Queen had made many journeys with a normal operating staff, but for her final mission, Eunice had taken the ship out alone. There had been good reasons for that. Automation and reliability had been improved to the point where the vehicle could easily manage its own subsystems and damage repair, and beyond that, Eunice had not wanted to involve anyone else in what was unarguably a risky enterprise, taking her much further out and for longer than any previous deep space expedition. That, of course, and her natural unwillingness to share the limelight. But mass was fuel, and fuel was speed, and speed was time. Eunice would never have hauled the dead weight of five extra hibernation units and their associated mechanisms, many tons, Jeffrey guessed, if she only needed one for herself. Winter Queen had been outfitted and modified for each of its journeys. There was no reason for all that mass to have been left aboard. Pushing questions from his mind for the moment, Jeffrey continued along the spine of the ship. He passed through another set of pressure doors, and before him lay the command deck. It was windowless, more like the tactical room of a warship than an aircraft's cockpit. Windows had little utility on a deep space vehicle like this. It could steer and dock itself autonomously, and relay any external view to its crew via screens or org-generated figments.
The ship was dreaming of itself. Screens and readouts wrapped the space like the facets of a wasp's eye, seen from inside. Lines of housekeeping data scrolled in green and blue text, updating too quickly to read. Schematic diagrams fluttered from screen to screen in a constant, nervous dance. Reactor cross-sections, fuel management flow cycles. Other displays showed zoom-ins of the solar system at different scales. Planets and moons, their paths around the sun. Various trajectories and intercepts available to the ship at that moment, depending on fuel and time-energy trade-offs. Simulations and projections executing in neurotic loops, with only tiny, trifling variations from run to run. Everything changing and shuffling at a feverish pace. Jeffrey could take in the totality of it, but no single display held still long enough for him to grasp more than the sketchiest of details. One thing was clear, though. The ship still thought it was a ship. There were three chairs in the command deck, bulky acceleration couches, heavy and high-backed, and for all that the displays snared his attention, it could not have taken Jeffrey more than 5 or 10 seconds to notice that he was not alone. In the middle chair was Hector.
"What are you doing here?" he asked. "Where's Dos Santos?"
"Dos Santos ran into trouble answering your distress call. I'm your next best hope."
"Leave now," Hector told him.
Jeffrey propelled himself through the space. Between the displays were margins of padded walling set with handles and elastic hoops. His foot brushed one of the displays. It flexed, absorbing the pressure before gently repelling him. "What's happening?" he asked, facing Hector directly. "Why are you still aboard?"
"Because I had to know," Hector said. "Because I had to fucking know. Why else? What happened to Dos Santos? Why are you here, cousin?"
Jeffrey's eyes amped up to compensate for the low ambient lighting on the command deck. Hector wasn't just sitting in the central command seat. He was strapped there, with a heavy X-shaped webbing across his chest and tough-looking restraints around his wrists and ankles. Like Jeffrey, he was wearing only the inner layer of a spacesuit. "I'm here because I thought you might be in trouble," Jeffrey said, still trying to get his bearings. "The station attacked the Kinyeti. The crew's still alive, but the ship's a wreck. Jumai and I came aboard afterwards using the other docking hub. We found the 4 demolition charges you left behind and assumed you'd come aboard with the others. Is that the case? Did you arm them?"
"Not an issue now. There's 11 minutes on the fuses if my timing's right."
Jeffrey shook his head. "How can that not be an issue? Tell me where the charges are. I'll disarm them."
"Just leave. You have a few minutes."
"You just said I had 11 minutes.
"Different countdown."
Hector nodded, which was all he could do given the degree to which his movements were impaired.
"The screen ahead of me. It's the only one that hasn't changed."
Jeffrey followed his gaze with a peculiar kind of dread. He saw what Hector meant. 3 sets of double digits. Hours, minutes, seconds. The hours had reached 0. There were 4 minutes left, and a handful of churning seconds. "What the hell?"
"It initiated as soon as I hit a certain level of the ship's file system. Some kind of self-destruct, obviously."
Hector sounded insanely calm and resigned, as if he'd had years to accept his fate.
"I can't get out of this chair. It's locked me in. But you've still got time. You don't need a suit, and the elevator's still working to take you all the way back to the hub. Use my ferry. I assume it's still docked."
Jeffrey was too stunned to answer immediately. "The charges," he said, when he could push a clear thought through his head. "Tell me where they are."
"You're not listening. It doesn't matter now. You need to leave."
"Until we know what that countdown means, I'm not going to assume anything. Where are the charges?" Hector groaned, as if all this was an insuperable nuisance.
"To the rear, next to the last bulkhead before the engine section. That's as close as I could get. I assumed it would be sufficient."
"Maybe I should work on getting you out of that seat first." Hector rolled his eyes.
"With the heavy cutting equipment you happen to bring with you."
"There's got to be something I can use somewhere on the ship."
"Good luck finding it in less than 4 minutes."
Jeffrey pushed himself away. He left the command deck, working his way back down the ship as quickly as his limbs allowed. The doors opened for him all the way back to the point where he'd come in. Through a small porthole, he saw the centrifuge arms still wheeling around. Hector was being optimistic, he thought. Even with 4 minutes, it would have been a stretch to reach space and safe distance before the Winter Queen's countdown touched zero. He doubted that he even had time to escape the demolition charges.